They're actually listening to a real person that is broadcasting live, and they're playing music that is brand new, and it gives them the opportunity to kind of discover new music as well.
Today on Radio Survivor, we gear up for College Radio Day.
Paul talks with the organizers behind the upcoming Grassroots Radio Conference.
And in College Radio Watch, Jennifer has an update on the resale of Rice University's former college station.
I'm Eric Klein, one of your hosts on Radio Survivor.
I'm the other host. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel. And we have a packed show today.
Yeah, I'm excited about today's show.
We get to learn about about one really cool station that's hosting the Grassroots Radio Conference.
It's a new station.
It's a new station, and it is the first pagan-owned station. So I'm really excited for people to learn about that and to learn about College Radio Day. And we're going to mix things up today, and we're going to start the show with a word from our friend Matthew Lassar.
Here is Lassar's Letter on Radio.
This is Matthew Lassar with Lassar's Letter on Radio. Bet you know who this is.
Well, when I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I see a man in your life.
What, only one?
I changed my mind.
Yeah, does it work any better? Well, when I'm caught between two evils, I generally like to take the one I never tried.
That's right. It's Mae West, star of spicy, funny movies during the Depression years. But did you know that she was once banned from radio? Here's what happened. In 1937, West appeared on the popular Chase and Sanborn Hour in a sketch written by Arch Obler titled The Garden of Eden. West played Eve. The show's smooth announcer Don Ameche played Adam. Comic ventriloquist Edgar Bergen brought in his world-famous dummy Charlie McCarthy as the snake. Here's some of the sketch.
Listen, tall, tan, and tired. It's time I told you a thing or two. Ever since creation, I've done nothing but playing double solitaire. It's disgusting. It's got me down.
Well, we've got a nice place here.
That's the trouble. It's too nice.
Well, I'm not complaining.
But I want something to happen. A little excitement, a little adventure. A girl's got to have a little fun once in a while. There's no future under a fig tree.
Oh. Now, come on, woman. Be like me. Why don't you relax and just take it easy, huh?
Because I'm a lady of big ideas.
Yeah, what kind of ideas?
You've no idea.
That's Mae West is a very bored and bothered Eve in the Garden of Eden. If you read the transcript of the show, it comes off as a kind of acute exercise in college town humor. But as the radio historian Eric Barnu later wrote, West filled out the dialogue with oohs and grunts that brought in thousands of angry letters.
Oh, Adam.
What?
Come on over here.
What for, to hold hands?
Oh, that old game? Can't you think of something new? You know nothing about nothing.
Oh, yes, I do. I know more than you do, woman.
Oh, what, for instance?
I know all about the tree.
What tree, man? What tree?
That apple tree in the middle of the garden. The lease says that if we eat any of its fruit, we get thrown out of here.
Oh, now, is that a fact?
Sure, that's why there's a fence around it. I tell you, one bite of those apples and we get a dispossessed.
How fascinating.
In any event, NBC quickly responded to the program with the nuclear option. West was not only barred from appearing on any NBC affiliate, the corporation forbade her name being mentioned on any NBC station. Neither Don Ameche or Ed Bergen suffered any punishment. West put a brave face on the setback. In fact, she is often quoted as saying, "I believe in censorship. I made a fortune out of it." But she only made two more big movies in the following decade, most notably My Little Chickadee with W.C. Fields, and she didn't get another radio gig for a dozen years. As for NBC, in the late 1940s, the government concluded that its two radio networks were one too many and forced the company to give up one of its ribs, so to speak. This is Lassar's Letter on Radio for the Radio Survivor podcast, reminding you that corporate censorship is no better than government censorship, especially if the corporation in question has near monopoly power over a media market. Thank you for considering my words.
You know I've been mad about you from the first time I laid eyes on you. Well, you're my whole world. What do you want to do, drive me to a madhouse?
No, I'll call you a taxi.
Young lady, are you trying to show contempt for this court?
No, I'm doing my best to hide it.
I wonder what kind of a woman you really are.
Too bad, but I can't give out samples.
Thanks, Matthew.
Next up, we're going to learn about College Radio Day, which is coming up on October 2nd. Jennifer Waits sat down to talk with Anthony Saya, who is a college radio broadcaster at KUOI at the University of Idaho, and is also the president of the New College Radio Foundation. He started off by explaining the origin of College Radio Day.
Historically, it was founded specifically with the history of stations being shut down in the United States. KUSF, WRVU, KTRU at Rice University. The whole idea behind it was that Dr. Rob Quick, who founded the organization, wanted to essentially raise the profile of college radio to essentially help radio stations that might be under scrutiny as far as being involved in their universities and their universities not being quite sure whether or not it was something that they wanted to continue investing money into, meaning that we wanted to essentially say, hey, we're a college radio station on this campus. We have a voice. We are important to the whole dynamic of the university campus. Whether you see us or not physically on campus, you hear us on the airwaves. And, you know, it's a place for students to essentially go and have a place to not necessarily escape, but have an alternative educational experience. Some radio stations, they have their journalism department and radio broadcasting department as part of their college radio station, but others don't. So allowing those students to essentially go into a radio station and be able to kind of share their voice and share, you know, the music that they love with their friends, but also gain some professional experience as well. There are students, particularly from my radio station at KUOI, that have gone to do some pretty amazing things, even though they weren't even a broadcasting or radio student at the time. They took that experience and they were able to make something professionally for themselves. We really worked to try and reach out to media outlets in these towns where these college radio stations exist that are participating and say, hey, this is College Radio Day. This is what's going on. But we're also aiming at those that aren't participating. There are still college radio stations out there that don't know that College Radio Day exists. So we're really trying to do a lot of outreach and make sure that people know about it. In addition to that, we reach out to national press as well. So we're really trying to push that awareness by essentially reaching out to all facets of the national public to let them know that, hey, support your college radio station because they're really doing some interesting and dynamic stuff. And you're missing it.
So this year it's happening on October 2nd. And it sounds like it's the fifth year that College Radio Day has happened. And over the years, how would you say College Radio Day has changed as an event?
I think as an event, it's changed ever so slightly. It's changed in that as the years go by, we have more stations that are being interested in being involved. We've had a couple albums, music that was curated by the College Radio Day Soundboard, which was made up of members of college radio stations from the United States. We did a couple albums, and then we kind of wanted to step away from that and make it to where it wasn't necessarily everybody was looking forward to an album every year. We wanted to make it more focused on the stations themselves. So last year and what we're doing this year is we're really putting the day itself back into the college radio station's hands. We want them to be able to celebrate themselves instead of saying, okay, we have, you know, all of this content for you to essentially play and it's all going to be the same across all these other college radio stations. We really want them to celebrate who they are in their community. In addition, we are bringing back the simulcast, which is something that is in its second year. So there'll be a 1 hour simulcast that's put together by the College Radio Day Board of Directors, as well as contributors from stations from around the nation. And we're actually launching a dedicated tune-in radio station named College Radio Forever. And this station is essentially going to play 2 hours of programming from college radio stations that have registered for College Radio Day 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They will hear it on tunein.com under the radio station College Radio Forever. We actually will then host the 24-hour national marathon. KTRU, the station at Rice University that lost their broadcast license in 2010, recently was given a low-power FM license, and they'll be broadcasting on 96.1 FM. they'll actually turn on their transmitter on College Radio Day starting at midnight on October 2nd, and they will launch the 24-hour National Marathon.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
In addition to that, we're actually consolidating all of our web presence, because it's a bit fragmented at this point, to one location at collegeradio.org. And collegeradio.org will take care of the College Radio Foundation, which is a newly founded 501c3, College Radio Day, College Radio Records. And then we're actually getting ready to launch a music review website, kind of getting those students that are participating in College Radio Day the opportunity to write and review albums that come into their station and have it published on this page, entitling it New Music Faster.
And then for College Radio Day overall, how many stations do you have signed up to participate this year for the whole day?
Currently, we are sitting at 275. As students are coming back to their stations, we've seen an influx of registrations. The last time I checked my email this morning, we had about 10 that registered just today. Even though it is only one day, as the College Radio Day Board of Directors, we function all year. We're trying to make it to where college radio stations have a benefit for being involved in an organization. We're offering over $1,000 worth of benefits for participating radio stations just for signing up for a free event that they only have to participate in one day a year.
So if people are interested in College Radio Day, how can listeners and college radio supporters participate in the whole experience?
The whole idea is that we're trying to raise greater national awareness for college and high school radio stations, mainly college at this point, that operate in the U.S., by encouraging people that typically listen to maybe, you know, the top 40 radio station in their town, or they, you know, strictly listen to their iTunes playlist or, you know, Spotify or something like that. Hopefully at that point they like what they hear and they start to shed the trappings of the digital age of iTunes and Spotify and really embrace the terrestrial format that is radio, specifically in college radio stations. Because we feel that college radio itself launches artists or gives those listening the opportunity to hear music that they wouldn't necessarily hear. They're not hearing the same, you know, 40 songs that they're hearing on rotation on this top 40 radio station or something like that. They're actually listening to a real person that is broadcasting live, and they're playing music that is brand new, and it gives them the opportunity to kind of discover new music as well.
And if there are strange people out there who don't know how to find college radio stations, are you guys giving them sort of an overview of the stations who are participating so that they can easily find streams that they could listen to online or a list of stations they can tune into in their local area?
Absolutely. And so what we're doing is actually on collegeradioday.com, there'll be a page that actually lists all participating stations. They can click on the United States map. They can click on the state that they're from, and it gives a list of all the stations that are participating in College Radio Day. From there, say you clicked on Washington, there's also a TuneIn web stream directly next to that logo for that college radio station. They can essentially click play and hear what's precisely going on air right there.
That's super cool. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for talking to us at Radio Survivor about College Radio Day. And we look forward to tuning in and hearing what everybody has planned for the day.
Thank you very much for having me. It was wonderful.
So that was Radio Survivor's own Jennifer Waits speaking with Anthony Saya, the president of the College Radio Day Foundation. And this is why I love working on this show, because I don't know if I would have found out about College Radio Day. And now I am excited about College Radio Day. And I've already subscribed to that TuneIn channel that Anthony Saya mentioned. TuneIn is my app on my phone that I use to listen to terrestrial radio stations around the country and in my own neighborhood that I can't get on my phone. I have to use the internet. And now I've subscribed to that stream that Anthony Saya mentioned, the one that is reportedly a 2-hour rotating cadre of college stations.
Yeah, I wish
that's like a dream come true for me.
I wish we'd had that when I was in college radio. Of course, we barely had internet. I mean, I did not have access to the internet then, although the internet did exist. And there was no streaming radio on the internet then, but still would have been great to have an event even without the internet, getting all college radio stations to probably send tapes
Yeah.
Back and forth to each other and compile things. That would have been a lot of fun.
That's great. Well, I'm gonna spend the next week or two listening to it, and I'll let you know just how good I think it is.
And tell us what you think about college radio. Did you do radio in college? Are you still doing radio in college? Are you someone who graduated and still participates in a college radio station? Why? Why do you enjoy it? What's so great about college radio for you? We'd love to know. Send us an email, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. Even better, we'd love for you to record just a little short segment of you telling us in your own voice, in your own words, why you love college radio or why you think college radio is important. And we'd love to share that with all the listeners here to Radio Survivor.
I'd like to hear from somebody who just loves a station in the town where they live that's a college station.
Mm-hmm.
Why? What is your opinion about that station, and why do you listen to it? Why is it a part of your listening habits?
Yes, we'd love to share that. We'd love to hear it, first of all, and we'd love to share it with the listeners of Radio Survivor. So just drop us a line there to podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And while we're asking you to do things, it would be great if you would go to iTunes and click on some stars or write us a review. We really appreciate it. And it doesn't have to be a glowing review. If you've got some constructive criticism, that's great too. But reviews on iTunes help us get found, help more people learn about the show. And we think that's a good thing because that means then more people are joining this conversation about what makes great radio for real communities. So if you could do that, that's great. You can search for it, or there are links at our website. Go to radiosurvivor.com/podcast. Next up, we're going to hear about another event worth looking forward to, the Grassroots Radio Conference happening September 24th through 27th. And the Grassroots Radio Conferences have been happening in one form or another since 1996. And I remember when these came together, I was at WEFT in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, doing a lot of work there. And it sort of started as the Grassroots Radio Coalition, which is kind of an email list, and people starting to talk about how can community stations that have a real grassroots element start working together more in a kind of mutual aid kind of situation. Sure. Rather than creating a new organization or a trade group or something like that. And organizing me around the Grassroots Radio Conference and the coalition was really spearheaded by two people, Marty Derlin, who is at KGNU, a community station in Boulder, Colorado, and Kathy Melio, who is at WERU in Bar Harbor, Maine. And so both KGNU and WERU were two of the original hosts, and I think they hosted two or three of the first conferences. And then it became much more of a grassroots thing where stations year to year would volunteer to host and to do the organizing. So instead of there being this sort of consistent, like, you know, two or three people doing it all, it would pass from station to station. And again, in that spirit of mutual aid rather than there being some sort of centralized organization. And it's happened more or less annually since then. I think there have been a couple of years where there just wasn't a host station. Last year is at KHOI in Ames, Iowa, which is a new full-power community radio station. It's been on the air, I think, just a year or so now. And this year, it will be hosted by WLPP, a new low-power FM station in upstate New York. I talked with the organizers of this year's Grassroots Radio Conference at that station. To start, WLPP's general manager, Catherine Platine, told me what attendees can expect.
You're going to learn everything from how do you be in compliance with FCC regulations to how do you do programming. What do you tell that person that you're sticking in front of the microphone on how to run it and how to put together a show? You're going to learn think, what equipment should I buy? How can I save a buck buying that equipment? You're going to learn pretty much everything you're going to need to know to run a radio station.
Donna DiBianco is a radio station startup specialist who is also working on this year's GRC. She detailed how the conference is going to run.
The conference is a three-day intensive, basically. First day, we start out pretty light, getting to know each other. We're going to have talking circles. We're doing s'mores and hot cocoa around a fire pit, movies and entertainment. And then Friday is when it really kicks off with the all-day workshops.
Catherine and Donna explained that a diverse array of community broadcasters with a range of experience will be attending GRC. In particular, Donna emphasized that experienced folks from long-standing stations will be there to share their wisdom, and there will also be technical experts giving workshops on engineering, as well as computer topics like open-source software and automation systems. The location for the conference, Palinville, New York, is located about 10 miles north of Woodstock, and WLPP's program director, Victoria Whitaker, explained why the area makes a good setting for GRC.
And you could not possibly hope for a better, more beautiful location for it. This town is considered to be the home of Rip Van Winkle. You've got beautiful mountains everywhere, and about at the end of September, that's when it's peak foliage time.
Now, host station WLPP is unique because it is the first pagan-owned radio station in the United States. Catherine Platine describes their religion and their church where the station is based.
We are a restoration of an ancient mother goddess tradition that actually was the only official religion of Rome for over 500 years, even though historians like to ignore that fact. We are a religious church, convent. We do charitable work. That's primarily what our focus is. And the theme of this year's grassroots radio conference is what happens when the FCC licenses a bunch of witches.
And I also wanted to add to that the word matrium. This is one of those words that was pretty much lost from the language after Rome became Christian and all the pagan groups either died out or were killed off. The word matrium means home of the mother, and specifically it refers to a church or temple that's dedicated exclusively to the worship of a mother goddess. It's a word that, as I said, was lost, and we wanted to revive it. That's why we call ourselves the Matrium of Sibel. The Sibel is specifically the goddess that we are dedicated to.
Although the station does feature programming dedicated to their religious issues, its overall program schedule should be familiar to most community radio listeners.
Oh, we're very eclectic. We're a Pacifica affiliate, so we do run things like Democracy Now! And The Hartman Show, David Pakman. But we also run a lot of music as well. Try to keep it as balanced as possible. The locals seem to be reacting extremely well. We're getting lots of compliments on the fact that we play music they haven't heard since they were kids. Not to mention that the talk shows are actually quite popular as well.
Yeah, we're also trying to add as much local programming as we can. But like she said, we like to keep it a mix.
Exactly. And I'd like to say, you know, just from my observations here, that the station airwaves that are being utilized here are of a full holistic community service rather than just a religious or idea set. Now, there are some, you know, green shows and goddess shows on the air, but it's not modeled after the Christian radio network kind of thing.
So that's a little information about the new low-power community radio station, WLPP, in Palinville, New York, which will be hosting this year's Grassroots Radio Conference. The conference is happening September 24th through 27th, and you can learn more and register online at grc2015.net.
Well, thanks for that interview, Paul. Have you ever been to a grassroots radio conference?
You know, I've been to two, and I feel a little ashamed to say that I've only been to two. I feel like I've been in community radio, especially at like grassroots stations, that I should have been to more. But and they were both very different. So I went for the first time in 2000.
Okay.
When it was hosted by WORT in Madison, Wisconsin.
So the fourth or the third.
Something like that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think WORT was the first station besides We Are You and KGNU, the two founding stations, to host. And partly it was just convenient. I lived in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, so that's about a four-hour drive from Madison. And Madison's a very nice place to visit anyway. And at that time, we were in the sort of throes of the anti-globalization movement. And so that
– indie media days.
Yeah. So we were – you know, it is a year into indie media being a thing, the Independent Media Center, which was the news gathering side of really the anti-globalization movement that kind of – really came on the scene in the U.S. at the very least at the WTO ministerials held in Seattle, Washington in 1999.
Have we covered that on this show?
We have not covered it all. And I have a lot of tape of that on mini disc. So it's not really tape. I have a lot of disc on that from my days in radio then.
It's coming up then. I'm making a prediction right here.
We might be able to. Yeah, I have report backs from people who were there on the ground. Anyway, we'll put a bookmarker on that, and we'll come back to it.
But it places this anecdote in time.
In time, And so that seemed to be a lot of the discussion, you know, that was about how stations are covering and how are they collaborating and what does this new, you know, grassroots journalism, citizen journalism. Mean for community radio.
Well, especially if people who weren't paying attention to this sort of stuff at that time, these stories like the WTO protest in Seattle were being either ignored in the mainstream media. It's a cliche now to even say that phrase, ignored in the mainstream media or covered in a very strange, condescending manner. And so to have media created around these events to share with the national audience on this new thing called the internet. That was a really big deal. And I'm sure an exciting time to talk about that stuff.
Because we have to remember this was a time before YouTube or Pinterest or Periscope
or Facebook or Twitter.
So the ability, this idea
I don't even think they were giving away blogs yet.
I think Blogger maybe had just started to exist, but it was text only.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think there was even a facility to put up photos. So this idea that there was a network, as it turned out to be, of websites that was also coordinating with community radio and coordinating with public access television, because those were really two big sites of coordination, these reports directly from the streets of Seattle that people weren't taking on their smartphones because they didn't have them yet, but who were taking on their tape recorders often or camcorders and running them back to physical centers where they had internet access, putting them up on the web so that community stations, public access stations, and other folks could go watch and listen to them was revolutionary. And so much of the discussion was, how does community radio work with this, respond, become a partner in this new site of grassroots journalism? And it was also just cool meeting people.
Cool.
It was my first time, I think, meeting in person folks from WORT, which is a great station. It's where I first met John Anderson, Professor John Anderson, who has been a guest on our program, expert on pirate radio in particular.
At the year 2000, a grassroots radio conference.
Yeah, this was before he started graduate school.
There you go.
So it was great. And then I went back in 2012, and it was hosted in Urbana, Illinois.
A place where I spent a whole generation later.
A long time, but I had since moved away. And it was hosted by the Independent Media Center there, which I helped to co-found back in the early parts of the 2000s. And it has a radio station, WRFU, a low-power FM station. That was one of the stations of that first wave of low-power FM that came out of the 2000 licensing window. And so it was kind of a homecoming. I was living in Chicago at the time. And that was fun. And it was different because I think that there was much more discussion about low power FM, although the new window had not yet been announced. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know there was going to be another 2000 stations on the air as they're going on now. But again, good discussions about grassroots radio and or folks from many more folks from college radio stations or folks who were organizing around internet stations. Either because these were folks who had been around, like say a college station that no longer existed, or because they knew they couldn't get a terrestrial signal. And so we're trying to figure out a way to do internet radio that would be community radio. So it was kind of a, a, different and varied constituency. Mm-hmm. And again, I know there was skill building workshops and, you know, and definitely with, workshops on legal issues and dealing with the FCC and other issues. And the big part of it is just simply meeting other great community radio folks.
Right.
And networking, and you know, not in a slimy sort of way, but in a way that it's great for us all to know each other. And,
yeah.
And the folks I met at 2012, I'm still in touch with in many ways. So it was a really great experience.
If anyone who's listening to this podcast, this radio program, has been to a grassroots radio conference, I implore you to share with us your experience, because I've never been to one. And I would love to go. It would really be a privilege to get to attend something like this. And I want to know how you experienced it. I imagine there might be somebody who made some radio about a grassroots radio conference. And I'm going to go hunting on the internet for what I can find. But if you happen to know of somebody, or if you yourself have some tape, share it with us about any of the years past. And then thirdly, if someone's going...
Yeah, report back to us. I don't think that I'm going to be able to go, and Eric, it seems like you will not be able to go. I'm not sure anybody at Radio Survivor is going to be able to go this year. So if anyone wanted to report back in audio, in text, in any which way, we invite it,
yeah.
And sort of spread the word and share the knowledge. Again, drop us that line. Let us know. podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
Please do. Up next on the program, College Radio Watch with Jennifer Waits.
Last week, we talked a bit about some news that the University of Houston was planning to sell off the license for their classical music station, KUHA, which was the former college radio station, KTRU-FM, in Houston, Texas. And so it was interesting to hear this news, because there was a lot of backlash and anger from students at Rice University and from supporters of the former college radio station, KTRU-FM. They were upset about the station getting sold to this local public radio group. So now here we are, several years later, finding out that University of Houston plans to put that license back up for sale again. So when you and I talked on the podcast last week, I talked a bit about, you know, I wonder what the reaction is going to be from supporters of KTRU when they find out that the license is for sale again. And then a few days later, in the Houston Chronicle, there was a really interesting opinion piece by the former KTRU station manager, Joey Yang. And in his opinion piece, he actually calls for the return of the license to Rice University. And he's basically asking Rice to buy back the license and kind of make the situation right. And he writes, "This creates a second chance for Rice to do the right thing and pay its debts to its students and Houstonians. Rice should buy back 91.7 FM. And it's a really passionate editorial. It's very well written, kind of mapping out the history of KTRU and that it was truly a student organization. It was built by students and achieved its prominence because of students, but then it was the school that ended up profiting from the sale. So I think he really eloquently outlines that in his piece. I wanted to read just a little bit from his editorial. Joey Yang said, "The station was built by students, tinkerers, engineers, and music lovers. It wasn't a gift Rice gave to students. KTRU was funded and built from scratch by the students slowly over 45 years. The station started in 1967 as a 2-watt AM station." So I think that's a piece of some of these stories that people might not necessarily realize, is that some of these student stations were built very much under the radar of the administration. And then over the years, you know, they go for power increases, they become more and more prominent, and then it's kind of sad that schools can then profit off of the labor that students have put in for generations. And also, somewhat related to this, we found out this week that KTRU, which now operates as an online station at Rice, and also they have an HD signal as well, they applied for a low-power FM license, and they got a construction permit for that. And they're going to be launching, actually, on October 2nd, so imminently, within a month. Rice will once again be broadcasting its student radio station over FM, but low power FM this time.
And of course, if it were to turn out that Rice University were to either buy or be gifted their former signal, they would have to probably divest themselves of the LPFM.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you have one entity can't own a low power FM license along with another FM license. There can be different entities at a school owning licenses, or a school can have one license that is utilized mainly by a public radio group and then another license that's used by students. That's permissible. You can have an LPFM license just for students if your school holds an FM license that is not used by students.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see what happens down there in Houston. And you also have a follow-up on another college radio station that you've been following closely, this time in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, so RAS, which is at Georgia State University in Atlanta, I mean, this was also something where in the past few weeks I was wondering about if there were any updates, because just about a year ago, Georgia State entered into a deal with Georgia Public Broadcasting, and now Georgia Public Broadcasting is using the RAS FM signal during the daytime to air public radio programming. And student programming over RAS is airing terrestrially at night, and then student programming is also being streamed over RAS's online stream 24 hours a day. So it's a situation where students lost the majority of their FM programming day about a year ago. And the last we'd heard was that there was an appeal by students in the spring, and we hadn't heard any updates about that. There was just an article that was published that gives a pretty in-depth update in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and it's looking at the situation a year later from all different angles, including how is this affecting student programmers, how is this affecting the public radio groups. As you might expect, in the report, they're saying that students are still quite unhappy about the situation. We haven't heard anything about the appeal from the spring. And also that it's kind of hurting participation in the station. Now that they don't have the daytime terrestrial broadcasts, it's actually working to somewhat diminish the number of students who are even attracted to the station. They're losing out on ticket giveaways, so local promoters aren't giving them tickets as much. And so it's having kind of this overall effect of dampening the mood at RAS, which is pretty sad, you know, because when the whole thing went down, of course, the administrators were saying, well, you know, we're just going to move programming online, so that shouldn't really have too much of an effect at all. But it's actually hurting listenership quite a bit at the station. And in the piece, this it says that DJs are seeing requests going down, so they're not getting as many calls from listeners. And if people aren't calling in, they're having a harder time giving away tickets. And so then it's harder to get promoters to give them tickets for shows. And so even their whole connection with the local music community is getting hurt by this.
And the station's call letters are WRAS, right? So that's, and they pronounce it RAS. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. WRAS-FM is RAS.
And when this change was made with the public radio station taking over the daytime hours on WRAS, how did the Georgia State University administration justify? What was their reasoning?
First of all, they said it wasn't about money, which is interesting. They said if it was about money, they would have just sold the license. And they said they had a lot of interest in the license, not just from Georgia Public Broadcasting, but from other groups who they didn't name. And in an interview with Georgia State student newspaper, The Signal, the president of Georgia State University, Mark Becker, he said, this is really a deal about providing students access and opportunity. He largely was talking about some little bonuses that were added into the mix. So Georgia Public Broadcasting promised a program, a music program that students at RAS could do, and then it would air over the whole public radio network that Georgia Public Broadcasting has. That actually hasn't happened yet. The public radio group is going to be airing public service announcements about Georgia State over the air. And so I think they feel like with a larger daytime audience, they're going to get messages out there about Georgia State, and that's going to help the school somehow. So yeah, it's really marketed as raising the profile of the station and the school. But I think from the perspective of students at RAS, they feel like that was kind of hollow promises. But all along, I think I've been suspicious. If you read through the paperwork, it seems like there was interest in purchasing the license. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's something that Georgia Public Broadcasting continues to pursue. You know, there's definitely language in there that made it sound like that was a possibility somewhere down the road.
Yeah, this starts to look like a test run, you know, an opportunity to see how well the Georgia Public Broadcasting programming floats on this signal and whether they can gain any sort of audience for it ahead of a purchase.
Yeah, I mean, it really wouldn't surprise me. And by the way, so last week we talked about KTRU in Houston as a 50,000-watt station, and RAS in Atlanta is 100,000 watts.
Wow.
So I really don't know of many college radio stations that are 100,000 watts, so it's not surprising that they've had a lot of interest over the years from various groups for their frequency.
And you mentioned that the students had filed some sort of appeal. To whom do they appeal in this kind of situation?
Yeah, so this was back in March 2015. They filed an appeal against the University System of Georgia Board of Regents. And the argument was that student activity fees had been misused in order to upgrade the WRAS signal. And so now that signal is largely being used by this outside public radio group. But if a lot of student money went towards this major purchase related to the station, they felt like that was something that merited further investigation. You know, but it sounds like they don't even have to respond to this appeal based on this article that came out this week in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The word in there is that the regents can choose to not even respond to it, which is sad because I think we've been waiting since March to find out what the board would have to say about these allegations, about the misuse of funds. So I'm hoping that we do get some sort of response.
Yeah, well, certainly I'm sure as soon as you learn something, you'll share it at radiosurvivor.com. Folks can find your weekly college radio updates every Friday. You can also go to radiosurvivor.com and just click on our college radio menu and find all of your coverage there. And of course, we'll put this in the show notes for this episode, so there's easy access to everything you've written about these two stations. Go to radiosurvivor.com/podcast. Well, I hope maybe next week we have some happier news about college radio.
Well, some of this is happy. I think I'd recommend reading Yang's editorial. I think it's a lovely ode to college radio in and of itself. So I don't think it's all bad.
Yeah, it is nice to hear a former college radio manager feeling so sanguine and about his experience and sharing that and getting published in what is a pretty big newspaper there in Houston. That is definitely good stuff. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
Well, thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Paul.
That was Jennifer Waits talking to Paul with College Radio Watch for this week.
You know, I got a thing to get off my chest here.
I'm all ears.
In the old Dennis Miller way, don't let me get off on a rant. But the other day, I listened to a podcast, and it was some guy. I don't want to name him. I don't want to single anybody out. And it came across my Twitter feed. And he's like, this is my very last podcast, and I'm going to explain why.
Oh.
Look. And I wasn't following him, but mm-hmm. Somebody I follow retweeted him. And I'm like, oh, this should be good. I want to hear this. So I listened to the podcast. And the guy was clearly trying not to sound put out or not to sound entitled. But to me, he sounded both put out and entitled. And the basic saw was, you know, I've put in this money. I've worked really hard to make a show that sounds good. And I'll say it sounded really good. He had a nice quiet room, nice microphones. Sounded better than our show. And
our show sounds great.
I think it sounds great. But I mean, it had that real like
he had
professional
more, he put more
sound.
Money into his microphones.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, I spent this money and I've done the show and it just, you know, it's becoming clear to me that I guess I don't have very more to contribute. And his show, I guess, was just sort of him ranting about stuff. So,
yeah.
And then he's, and my wife is, does a show about maybe craft beer, I think. And she puts a lot of work into it. And she's getting discouraged as well because, you know, maybe the, you know, we get a thousand people listen. And but mostly it's a couple hundred people listen and certainly not making any money at this. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, there are some great people doing podcasting and, you know, some of them making money. But I wonder if they're making money at podcasting or teaching people how to podcast, because that's certainly its own subgenre of the podcasting world.
Right.
And, you know, I say, well, who is the person who suddenly promulgated this idea that the road to riches was paved with podcasts?
This is funny because this is three things at once, and I'm so glad you brought this up for the end of the show today, because for one thing, I just need to jump in and announce, because I'm very excited about next week's guest who's coming into your home studio here where the equipment is very nice. You have very nice equipment to talk about retiring her podcast. And it should be a similar conversation, but I think it'll be vastly different because I think her reasons both it's Julie Sabatier who launched the podcast many years ago. She was an early adopter because she was a community radio
producer.
There's so much I want to say about her.
Well, she's very talented.
Yeah, and I think I knew her.
She's done great programs.
I knew her through Free Speech Radio News originally, and she has been here in Portland producing radio at KABU originally, and then moved on to OPB, where she's
Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Yeah, where she's a full-time producer of Portland's best radio show, in my opinion, Think Out Loud. It's a daily talk show where they take on the news. And she had a podcast, a radio show called Destination DIY, which then was renamed Rendered. And she's the person that I had the closest 6 degrees of separation to with the most successful podcast I was aware of.
Mm-hmm.
She was the closest person I know of to living the dream. And she just announced last week that she's not only taking a break, she announced that she's retiring the show.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to the conversation with her about, the reasons why she came to that very, that decision, which is similar to the guy that you're talking about. But also, I'm looking forward to talking about everything.
Well, I think it's important for people to kind of understand the realities on the ground.
Right.
You know, and, you know, I work for a company that makes money in podcasting, that helps other podcasters make money with advertising.
Right. So, and there's a bar, though. And the bar is higher than is what is attainable, even for your own show.
Well, right. And
but the bar is tens of thousands of listeners.
Yes.
And most podcasts are not going to attain that.
Precisely.
Which is okay.
Right. Exactly. Because, you know, when was it ever any different? So let's... Yes, I can and will dream about a world in which we can make a living, a fair wage, creating great news and art and things like that. That is the world I would prefer, and I'd like to work towards that. And
I want to imagine that there's 20,000 people in America or the world that want to listen to this show and just haven't heard about it yet.
Yes. But even putting aside the sort of that dynamic.
But what if there's only 5,000?
I would love for that to be some way in which somebody could just make a living, right? So make a fair wage. So not fame and riches, but make a fair wage. That's a world I'd like to live in. So I don't want to put aside that dream or that notion of what is ultimately social justice, whether it's a podcaster, an artist, an activist,
a community radio.
Right,
producer.
Exactly. So, but putting that aside, when was that thing that you could do, whether it was a blog or a zine or anything, where you would have this great riches ahead of you, or by simply expressing yourself and only expressing yourself, that people would flock to you. Now, yes, certainly there are some people who have found success in podcasting who probably came into it without any other
– Dan Carlin.
Right. Previously existing fame, right, of hardcore history.
All he does is a whole lot of reading and pre-production, and then he talks to himself.
And he's very good at it.
And he's making a living.
And he's very good at it.
Yeah. So that's the American dream.
It is. Right. Or even in community radio, you've had people who have really focused and created shows that are then syndicated. And, you know, to the extent to which, you know, like a show like Alternative Radio, hosted by David Barsamian, which he's been doing for 20 odd years.
He's like the godfather of, yeah, of that model.
Exactly. And you know, it's a nonprofit, but he makes a living at it. And he has people who work for Alternative Radio. It's been possible, but, it requires a lot of work. And I think with podcasting, there needs to be a reason to do it. And I would be great, I think, if we could make a living at doing Radio Survivor, both the podcast and the blog. But we know it's an uphill battle. We know that it requires asking people for money. We realize that it's that while we think there's a huge audience in one way, that the constituency still is very narrow. And we get this. I mean, I'm not under any delusion. Right. I think you get this. And yet, you know,
I think about it a lot.
Right. And you have to have that balance in your head of what I'm putting in and what I get out of it, which can include compensation, include money, but also include satisfaction, bringing, you know, hoping that you're adding to something, you're contributing something. Because I think about it, if we compare podcasting to golf,
right,
there's a hobby that you can spend a lot of money on, between greens fees and if you have a caddy, and people spend on lessons, not to mention the clothes and the equipment, right? Yeah. I mean, certainly it's possible to be a cheapskate golfer. I think I would be. But nevertheless, it's something you could spend a lot on. And I don't really hear people complaining, I spent all this money on golf and now I'm not on the PGA tour.
Yeah, you forgot that there's also a minority of people who make a living at it.
Right. Right. And there are people who make a living at golf who are on the tour, or maybe they are professional golf instructors or something along the lines. Right. And yet you don't really hear this lament. And then I've lately been hearing a lot of this lament of like, well, I've been doing all this podcasting and I'm not making a living at it.
Yeah.
And I would like to see many more podcasters making a living at what they
do. I like the golf metaphor because – yeah, no one says like I've been golfing all day.
Yeah, right.
All I did was golf all day.
Or I've been playing pickup games of basketball for 15 years, and I'm still not in the NBA.
So you should enjoy podcasting the same way you'd enjoy a walk around the block.
I think in some ways, I mean,
maybe you get to have a conversation with your neighbor. You enjoy. There's something about it you enjoy, and it's not.
Yeah,
there's no end game. I mean,
to me, the fact that several hundred people listen to every one of these episodes is fantastic. If we were on a community radio station, especially one that's not in a major metropolitan area, mm-hmm, and just doing a live show, the likelihood that there were even 300 or 400 people hearing us in a given moment is very low.
Right. Right?
'Cause that's the way radio listenership is. And so the privilege of us being able to speak to you who are listening right now is amazing. And the fact that we can reach as many people as we do who share this interest around the world is absolutely fabulous. And I don't want to lose that sense of wonder or that sense of recognizing this great privilege that we have with these microphones and an internet connection right now. Yes, I would love for more people to contribute to our Patreon campaign, patreon.com/radiosurvivor, and help us to do this and to help us
to
grow and to give more time to it.
Sure.
Like to be able to give more hours because we're not sort of stealing them away from other endeavors or from our family and friend time, right?
We're making an investment in something that we hope to pay off in the future.
Yeah, being able to invest maybe in some microphones that weren't in the bottom of my closet for the last 15 years or something like that. But that's just beside the point. I think to recognize that the platform is truly a privilege, and I'm grateful that it even exists. And this idea that just anyone could make a radio show is a very new one, right? That you can just make a radio show and distribute it not only just to people on the internet, but potentially to other radio stations.
So I've been listening. Amazing. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts outside of my usual comfort podcast world since this summer because of this show. I've been thinking about, well, where are all these other podcasts that I haven't been paying attention to? And it comes up in those podcasts. I've heard this conversation on other people's shows.
Like, now are they complaining that they don't have listeners or don't have money?
Or they're thinking about it.
I see.
They're either discussing it or they're joking about it or they're complaining about it. And it would seem as though everyone started podcasting hoping to get 10,000 listeners, and then they're finding out that they have 200. Or 100 or 80.
And I do not want to be there. I am so grateful. So just think about this, right? Yeah. And this is – so I will credit Scott Aukerman, who is a co-founder of Earwolf and created Comedy Bang Bang with this intuition. And the intuition was this. He says, so look, me as a comedian, you know, he would do shows at these venues in Los Angeles that hold several hundred people. Mm-hmm. And if it was a packed house, sold out, you feel good.
Right. Small room full of people.
Small room full of people. And even several hundred is not a small room, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this packed theater full
of people.
I'm
picturing the UCB where I actually saw one of Scott Aukerman's shows.
So packed house full of people. You feel good. And think about a podcast. You're reaching at least that many people without any limit because there's no fire codes. There's no tickets to buy.
And you're giving it away for free.
And you're giving it away for free. But he said, you know, even if you've got just 1,000 people listening, you've probably bigger than most of the venues you're likely to play as a comedian until you're at a certain echelon.
Yeah. There's a weird I feel like it's TV's fault.
Yeah. I mean, the expectations kind of get a little out of whack.
Because a TV show is supposed to have millions of viewers.
Right. But of course, a TV show is not something that you are easily going to just sit down and create. Now you can create a YouTube show and where you'll see, oh, you get so many thousands or sometimes millions of views. But that's also because you're using YouTube. And YouTube is like that platform. It's like that network. And podcasting doesn't have that yet. That's a whole nother discussion, I think, aside from iTunes, which isn't the same way.
Well, they don't host it.
They don't host it. You don't just watch it there or listen to it there. You know, so that's a different discussion, I think, but it's worth pointing out. But, you know, but that as a YouTuber, you rely a lot on YouTube. And YouTube, if they change the terms or change how things work, you'll feel it immediately. With podcasting, for better or worse, you kind of own it.
Yeah.
And you set the terms, but that ownership is a responsibility when it comes to growing audience, attracting people. But that's my way of saying that you, whoever's listening to this right now, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah.
I'm not, and I think it's always this kind of, you know, it's like lamenting that you don't have more listeners. It's kind of telling the listeners you have right now that they don't matter.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, it'd be like, oh, telling, like talking to your best friend. Oh, I wish I had more friends. I'd be like, well, what about me? What am I, chopped liver? Do I not matter? It's like funny. Every single one of you matters. The fact that we have you as a listener is so great. We're so appreciate having you.
But you're also talking to podcasters and you're recommending I was going to say lower your expectations, but then I'll say instead that a readjustment.
Understand that it's a privilege and that actually getting to talk to several hundred people is amazing because prior to podcasting existing, for most people, they never have that opportunity or had that opportunity. And there were gatekeepers and you had to pass through them, you know, and in many community radio stations, even it takes a while to get on the air because there are so many people who want the opportunity and only 24 hours in the day.
Yeah. There's even another thing. It's like you could see a podcast as it's getting very tiny. I'm shrinking my podcast idea down to the most minimalist. Mm-hmm. And it's like an opportunity to have a conversation with someone you're interested in.
Yeah.
And to have that conversation archived because maybe later it will be interesting. Instead of it sitting in your drawer on a tape, it is in public.
I think that's always been the impulse, whether it's been behind independent publishing. I mean, and even go to independent publishing, I think there are times when there have been book runs that are several hundred, and they're thrilled when it sells out at that level. to really kind of think about and really get concentrated on how much freedom you're afforded in being able to do this.
This is fun because Julie Sabatier also makes zines about how to make radio. So I know that she I'm sure she only made a few hundred copies of her zine.
And I'm a retired zinester as well, with a box full of unsold, ungiven away copies in my garage.
So this is a great ongoing topic. Why podcast at all?
Yeah. And make radio at all?
Yeah.
When you're on a low power station that has 100 watts, where maybe in some days there's, you know, only a dozen or two people listening at any time.
Did that guy quit? That complaining podcaster?
As far as you know, yeah, that was his last podcast. I didn't follow up because I didn't.
We should contact him really and buy his gear.
Maybe he donated to us. I don't know. But yeah, so I mean, you know, that's just my way. Is like, I, you know, and if you have to quit doing the thing, retire, that's fine too. And I understand that it could be too many hours that new things come across the horizon in life that require your time and energy. I think it's perfectly legitimate to say, hey, I'm not doing this anymore because I really hope to reach more people and it's not sustainable because of the time and there isn't the money, et cetera. Those are good reasons. I think it's what I objected to, what I heard in this person's voice was the entitlement, the idea that if I build it, they will come.
Yeah.
Rather than, oh, I've reached the end of the line. It's not really paying off for me. And I feel like I should tell people that. Not, you know, and let you know that it's no longer doing it for me, but here's the end of the line.
It's also interesting that we think about these radio shows and podcasts instead of thinking about them as a book. Like, here's a body of work and I've completed it, and now it's there for you to step into and experience whenever you want to. A podcast that's a whole year old is kind of a sad thing, and I don't think it should be.
No.
I mean, I tend to go back and try to listen to old stuff of things I've discovered. But I also, it's not like you don't buy a book that you're interested in, turn to the copyright page and find, oh, this book was published 5 years ago.
Right.
I'm not going
to
read this.
You know, exactly. And I guess where I want to leave it is to say, anyone who's thinking about podcasting, do it. Do it, okay? Find a way and do it. Don't worry about when you can buy the $300 mic that you read on the forums that everyone says is the best mic that you should have. Just get it to be good enough. Borrow. Is there one that do you have a friend who has one? Is there one you bought a long time ago you ought to use?
If you're lucky enough to have an iPhone, you're done.
Yeah, exactly.
You could just use
that. Almost nearly done. Exactly. Start. Because you can always, one, get better, and one hopes that you will. And you'll learn the trade and you'll go forward with it. And have your expectations set that if you have listeners, you are so lucky. If you have thousands of listeners, you are really lucky. And you may go beyond that. It will take probably not just the hard work, but also, you know, marketing and making sure people know about it and lots of those things, or maybe someone will do that for you, but go forth and do it and understand also you don't have to make a commitment forever.
Right.
But really, I think to have a listenership at all, to have an audience, is a great privilege. I would love more people to have it. There are many more voices, I think, who are deserving of it. And if we can help or inspire people to go out and just get started, then I hope that we'll have done some good work.
Good rant, Paul.
Thank you for letting me rant. And thank you for listening. And let us know, what do you think? podcast@radiosurvivor.com. You know, rate us on iTunes. Give us a response. You could write a response to what I've just said and put it in a review for all to read there. And if you can help us out, we are putting up some bonuses up at our Patreon site for people who give at least $5 a month. That's patreon.com/radiosurvivor. It right now it gets plowed into just keeping this thing going, paying the hosting fees. We'd like to grow up past that, but that's a conversation for another time.
Thanks for the show, Paul. Thanks for putting
it
together.
Thank you, Eric.